Enjoy traditions that are centuries old and a good meal at the harvest festivals in rural Italy.
You have an excellent kind of food, which is absolutely local for a very little amount of money.
Discover the lively street life of Rome. Local guides tell us what they enjoy most about living in the Eternal City. Summer evenings along the Tiber River come highly recommended.
There is food fair, there is live music, there is a lot of people doing their passeggiata along the river.
We'll also hear what it was like to oppose Soviet control in Budapest in October of 1956. Michael Korda was there.
It was a very impressive demonstration of national feeling that was beyond any question of class, profession, or education.
We'll take you to Italy, from Rome to the countryside, and to an eyewitness account of the short-lived Hungarian Revolution. It's in the hour ahead on Travel with Rick Steves. It's almost 68 years to the day that a group of college students in Hungary demanded reforms from its strict communist government. In a bit, we'll remember the short-lived Hungarian Revolution with Michael Korda. The editor-in-chief emeritus at Simon & Schuster was a student himself at the time and drove from England to Budapest to witness what was happening. We'll also get an update on what's new in Rome to help you plan a visit as they spiff things up for the busy Jubilee year ahead. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves looking at the centuries-old celebrations called Sagra that pop up all over rural Italy in the fall. Our tour guide is vintner Cecilia Bottai, who comes to us from Orvieto in Umbria. Cecilia, thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So describe a sagra. What is that exactly?
Well, the sagra is an event that has a very long tradition and history. The sagra comes from sacred, sacro, because that was sort of a food or product festival that was done in front of the temples first, the churches next. In the church or temple yard, there would be a celebration because of that harvest went well and so forth.
So it's a harvest festival that
it's
goes...
It's a harvest festival, food fair, back to...
Ancient times?
Ancient, very ancient times.
Okay.
Sagra comes from sacro, sacred, and the space in front of the church that you call the churchyard or the temple yard.
So even in ancient times, thanking
the
gods for the harvest.
Thanking the gods for the harvest. And this is how this developed.
Now, how does a tourist today who's exploring Italy learn where these festivals are?
Well, you have posters everywhere. You go online, you Google Sagre in Italy, and you have a list of maybe 1,000.
Oh, my goodness. So Sagra in singular is S-A-G-R-A.
Yes.
And now, are they usually in the village, in front of the church, on the main square, at a farm? Where
they
would you
used
find it?
To be in front of the churches. This is what we call the sagrato, chiesa, the space in front of the church. Now they are in villages and in smaller sites, never in a city.
Never in a city?
No, they're only in these small villages.
Because it's a farm action thing.
It's more than a farm action thing. It's something related to the small community.
Okay.
And they also have a target now.
A target.
The target is to make some money for the community.
Oh, okay.
Let's suppose this community wants to make some extra money, need some extra money for the children's playgrounds. Okay, so they organize a festival, which is a sagra. Everybody volunteers. The money they make goes into that project.
And this village might be famous for its artichokes.
Well, artichokes are, you really have 1,000 at least.
Okay, so is it mostly in the fall during harvest time, or can it be also in the spring and summer?
Well, they go all year long. Of course, since one of the reasons is to make some extra money, not just to celebrate life together. Most of the sagras are done during the good season. That means when there is no rain, when there is more people around, when people have their holidays, so they can really gather together a lot of people to make what they want.
And but when would that be normally?
I would say they start around May and the end October.
Now, I'm thinking in terms of harvest in a farm, but is it also involving hunting? And
of course.
And, no. So what sort of a hunting dimension would there be to
wild
these
festivals? Wild boar sagra.
Wild boar.
Yeah. Have you ever had wild boar, Rick?
I have. I love it.
Have you ever seen a wild boar in front of you?
No.
Yeah, that's quite an experience, I can tell you.
So what is the meat that might be hunted and then celebrated in a sagra?
Could be meat, could be fish, could be jackrabbit, could be wild boar, could be any kind of bird that you can eat, could be any sort of fish that goes with a specific kind of pasta, the goose. We have close to Orvieto, the goose sagra.
I'm curious about this boar because I loved the boar meat. What might you eat in a village in Italy at a wild boar sagra?
You want to eat the wild boar stew. You might eat the local style of pasta with the wild boar ragu. Mm. You might eat the ham made with wild boar meat, the sausages made with wild boar meat. You can do a lot of different recipes with a wild boar.
So if you're going to a sagra, you should not eat first. You should come with an appetite.
No, you should not eat for a week, and then you go there and you eat.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're fantasizing about food right off of the farm, food fresh from the hunt, as we travel around Italy and we have our eyes peeled for a sagra. That's a village harvest festival. We're talking with Cecilia Botai, and Cecilia lives, splits her time in between a farm where she produces some beautiful wine in Orvieto and in Rome. Cecilia, describe some of your favorite memories of different sagri that you have stumbled onto or gone to for a little vacation.
Well, I can tell you that I like them all. And I can tell you that when I used to live in Florence, I would go out with friends in the countryside to have dinner at the sagra. Hmm. It's a nice experience because that is only cooked by very local people. Mm-hmm. The traditional cook is, you can picture a short woman, which we have an expression in Italy for how robust she is. It's easier to jump on her rather than walk around her because she's really the typical Italian
mother. So it's quicker to jump over her than walk around her.
Yeah,
okay.
Because they're very
so sort of a local babushka.
Yeah, a local babushka. Uh-huh. Perfect. And then you go there, you buy your ticket for the food you want to have, and then you sit on a bench close to people you never seen before in your life. They might be local people or tourists, but from Italy mainly. You have an excellent kind of food, or quality of food, sorry, which is absolutely local. Nothing comes from anywhere around. That's what we call kilometro zero, 0 mile. That means it's really local for a very little amount of money. And you feed yourself with, what can I say, 12, 13 euro. Uh-huh. You can talk with somebody who's next to you. You enjoy an open space. If you have children, they can play around. And that's it.
And I would imagine there's some local wine along with that 0 kilometer concept.
Can you imagine a meal without wine in Italy?
You cannot.
Can imagine it, but it doesn't exist.
So you got your wine and you got your passionate, whatever they're cooking up, whatever they're growing, whatever they're hunting. You mentioned 0 kilometer. Tell me more about this, because I hear this term a lot when it comes to eating in a very local way. What is 0 kilometer eating in Italy?
0 kilometer eating means that you eat whatever dish or whatever cheese or whatever that comes from close by. If you have a 0 mile, that means something that has to be produced within 150 miles, actually, you have something which is absolutely local and you can make sure it's fresh.
It takes on a special quality because you know you've got that heritage, the sustainability, if you care about the environment, you
Absolutely.
Didn't spend a lot of extra energy.
Absolutely. And you very often know who made them. So I know who made that cheese. In Italy, we have very often this tradition, generations after generations doing the same thing. You know, myself, I'm one of them.
Because of your wine.
Because of my wines. Yeah. But I know people who've been making cheese for whatever years, so many generations. So I know where the cheese come from. And now we have people going back to that. That's the surprise.
So there is a movement not to the supermarket in the suburbs, but to 0 kilometer eating.
Not only that, to abandoning the modern contemporary life. Mm-hmm. They quit a very nice and profitable job and they start remaking the real food.
It's more expensive.
It's more expensive. But wait a second. We are in Italy now redeveloping a non-wasting way of cooking. What do you mean? In the past, you would cook a cow. Let's say if you're not vegetarian, you cook the cow, we say, from the horns to the tail. The tail is called alla vaccinara. It's a very famous Roman recipe. In the 70s, you would have only filet. And now we're getting back to that. What do I do with the tongue? What do I do with the tail? Well, the same is for smaller animals, chicken. What do I do with the chicken? I can boil the chicken. I can make the broth. I can make the soup. I eat the meat and I cook the veggies together. And if one chicken costs you 20 euro instead of 5, but you have the ability to make with one chicken the entire meal, in the end you eat better and costs you less time and money.
Cecilia Botai leads tours of Italy from her home base in Rome and manages her family estate winery in the hills of Umbria overlooking Orvieto. Right now on Travel with Rick Steves, she's cluing us in on the agricultural sagra festivals that you can find scattered around the Italian countryside in late summer and fall. Cecilia, I'm just going to say a few words, And I'd like you to just talk about what that might mean to you, where you might find it at a sagra. Gnocchi.
Gnocchi. La sagra degli gnocchi. I have one very close by me, Lake Bolsena, because that is an area where they make great potatoes.
So they have potatoes, they celebrate their gnocchi, and you can go to a village.
To a village where you have the gnocchi made there.
Porcini mushrooms.
Porcini mushrooms, it's usually end of August when they do it, or October in Tuscany, in the Chianti region. Otherwise, the mushrooms, sagras, are also in the Maremma Toscana, which is the coast of Tuscany. Mm-hmm. And this is when you get them and where you get them.
And that would be in the late summer and
early fall.
Tortellini.
Tortellini, Emilia Romagna. You have to go there. Absolutely. Although they make tortellini everywhere, but Emilia Romagna is famous for
that. Where is Emilia Romagna?
Emilia Romagna is what we consider, geographically speaking, the start of the north of Italy, which is right north of Florence. When you cross the Apennine, the Appennini, you get to Bologna.
Uh-huh.
Let's say Pavarotti's area.
Okay. And I'm sure he enjoyed a few sagras.
Oh, yes, I'm sure.
Polenta.
Polenta, you have it both in Emilia-Romagna and in the Veneto region. Veneto region is Venezia, Verona. This is where they're famous for polenta, that you can dress with any sauce you want.
Because you have, it's like cornbread. But
it's cornbread.
How would you dress it up with different sauces?
You can make it with ragu. You can make it with the stockfish, polenta con bacala. It's very mm-hmm. famous up there. You can make it with cheeses. If you live up in the north where they have the mountains with the uh-huh. beautiful cheeses, you make the polenta and you have the cheese that melts on top of the polenta. Oh. It's, not for a Weight Watchers diet, but it's tasty, I can tell you.
Now, it is so fun to be able to just talk with you and imagine a lifetime of enjoying these festivals of food. For the little finishing off of our conversation here, share with me one favorite moment that you've had at a sagra.
Well, I was with a lot of friends that was in the Maremma area, and there was the sagra of the porcini. And we sat there, we were already quite a few people. There was a long table. All of a sudden, we started speaking with the people next to us because we had to sort of split in the group because there was not enough room for us. And we found ourselves in a table that was covering almost all over Italy. And you know how I call my country, the United States of Italy. We had lovely food, and I was sharing some experiences with someone from Sicily. My husband, who's from Calabria, was sharing with somebody from Piemonte. All of a sudden, that became a long table of friends who had never seen each other before. And we are talking about the difference on how to cook the porcini here and there, how you would enjoy them the best. And in Tuscany, and then there was a little bit of a conflict, who made the best ones, of course. But that was so Italian. And we spent 2.5 hours with people we never knew before that moment. And that it was a memorable night.
Cecilia Bottai, buon appetito and mille grazie.
Thank you. La ricetta di Cicirinella, compagna di
Cella, precisa mamma. We have a link to Cecilia's family winery called Tenuta La Valletta. It's with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Next, we get clued in on what's happening in Rome, what's new to look for and look out for. And in a bit, a longtime editor-in-chief at book publisher Simon & Schuster tells us what he encountered in Budapest back in 1956. Michael Korda went there to witness and perhaps help out with the popular uprising against its repressive communist rulers. Rome has a history spanning 28 centuries, and part of the timeless appeal of what people call the Eternal City is that it's also constantly changing and evolving. And that can pose a challenge to today's travelers. Beyond navigating the ancient ruins, modern traffic, and nearly 4 million people all around you, thankfully, I'm joined by two top-notch guides to update us on what's going on in their city. Virginia Agustinelli and Vanessa Nicole live and guide in Rome. Virginia and Vanessa, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Rick. It's a pleasure.
So nice to have you right here in our studio. First of all, Virginia, you lived in Seattle for a long time, 18 years. You're Italian, you lived in Seattle, and now you're back in Rome. What's that like to have been in America and then back in Rome?
It was a bit of a drastic switch from Seattle in particular, but I'm readjusting to the Roman rhythm of life, which is a little bit more chaotic and
faster.
In
Italy, you say bella chaos.
Yes,
sometimes.
Sometimes.
You've got more chaos. You've got more bureaucracy.
That's for sure. There's more bureaucracy, like you said. Everything seems a little bit more complicated.
And corrupt?
I wouldn't say that necessarily.
In the past, there was a lot of corruption that was frustrating, but now...
There is, but I mean, corruption in a way, it's in every country in different forms. Maybe it's a more obvious form of corruption.
But there's a different love of life, I think, in Italy, whether it's a big city or a small town. How's that? How do people do the tempo of life in Rome compared to the United States?
I think it's the priority they give to, for instance, just the work life in general. They don't have the same importance. So, you know, you can take a coffee break. You can take two coffee breaks. You can maybe take a couple of days off because you have some family meeting you want to go to. Whereas I think in the States, you have more pressure and you need to get the work done and you wouldn't feel well about that.
I think it suits different people differently. And I think you're having a good time in Rome. Vanessa, I'll never forget, I was researching my guidebooks in Trastevere, that wonderful neighborhood all on the other side of the river, the characteristic side of the river. I was just lost in my research. There was no tourist where I was. And then I bumped into you on your bicycle, and it just occurred to me, oh, yeah, Vanessa, you live in Trastevere. Tell me what your life is like in Trastevere.
Yeah, so what a coincidence. Huh? We did not mean to meet up, but yes, I was cycling past you.
Yeah.
So Rome, obviously, as you said, almost 4 million people. So it's a very big city to navigate your way around. Trastevere is my favorite part of Rome because it's like living in a small village within a big city. So you can have all the benefits of a big city, but you're in this self-sufficient area where actually there's not much traffic allowed into the center of Trastevere. So you can wake up in the morning and not hear the traffic, yet you're in the center of this pulsating, throbbing, wonderful place. I think when I met you, you were on your way to the famous Biscotteria Innocenti in Trastevere.
The cookie factory.
The cookie factory, exactly. You know, this lovely place where their family are still making their own biscuits in a very traditional way.
You know, that's such an amazing thing for a tourist. But for you, it's the lady who makes the cookies down the street.
Exactly. And it's such a luxury to have that. You know, you're in a big city, but you feel like you're in a small village. And that's why I love living there.
And you're a 20-minute bike ride or half-hour walk to Piazza Venezia in the center of Rome.
Exactly. And because it is a big city and there is a lot of traffic, and as you know, we don't have very many underground systems because of all those ancient Roman ruins, the bicycle for me is the best way to get around. Although a lot of my friends say, you must be crazy cycling around in these streets.
Mayors all over Europe are encouraging biking to the chagrin of drivers, I think. Our guides to Rome may have been born elsewhere, but they revel in offering an insider's perspective on the Italian capital today. Virginia Augustinelli was raised in a small town with a medieval castle in the mountains of Abruzzo, just a few hours east of Rome. It was her dream to live in the United States, so she taught at the University of Washington in Seattle while completing her doctorate in film and comparative literature. She's on the faculty with the university's Roman Residence Program and founded the Center for Sicilian Studies. Virginia also leads tours from Lake Como to Sicily. Vanessa Nicole's father is Scottish and her mother is Italian, so she was raised in both cultures. She's made Italy her home for most of her adult life. Vanessa offers private English lessons and shows visitors the pulse of daily life in her Trastevere neighborhood. They're with us right now on Travel with Rick Steves to help us get up to date on what we should know for visiting Rome today. Virginia, you also live in Rome, and I'm just curious, you've got, as a tour guide, both of you have a season and an off-season, and you also have the heat to deal with. Talk a little bit about that as a resident of Rome.
Yes, yes, it's correct. Well, in the last few years, the temperatures have definitely gone up. For instance, I have air conditioning in my apartment, but it doesn't seem to be sufficient. I need like a stronger air conditioning system, and it's unbearable temperatures. And it's not so much, you know, it gets in the 102, 103 in the summer, but it used to be like that 1, 2, 3 days in the summer. Now it's just consistent for about 5, 6, 10 days. And that's what really makes it difficult.
10 days of 100-degree weather, and it can be muggy too.
Yes, and you need to get out for a day trip outside of Rome, in that case, just to get some fresh air.
So is it pretty much understood that a big city with lots of concrete and lots of traffic and so on will be a few degrees hotter than a breezy beach or a little town in
the
hills?
That's correct. That actually raises the temperature of a couple of degrees. So it's just an objective reality.
Yeah. That's a sad thing from a sightseeing point of view and from a tour guiding point of view, because July and August, you have to earn your living, and it can be brutal.
Yep. I mean, if you're visiting the city, you can get around that. You can, you know, try to leave early in the morning, maybe take an early morning walk.
Well, let's talk about that. Yeah, because all over the Mediterranean these days, climate is going to be a challenge. Vanessa, what are some tips just for surviving in hot weather in a city on the Mediterranean like Rome?
So traditionally in Rome, it's always been very hot in August, which is why most people and the businesses would close down in August and everyone would vacate the city. Now what's happening is that that warm period, which was only in August when it was a bit unbearable, is now starting in July and even sometimes into June. Yeah. So traditionally we would, you know, in the evenings we would go up onto the hills. You know, there's like for the famous Gianicolo beside Trastevere, we'd go up onto the hills and we'd sit up and look at the viewpoint and have something to eat up there. But within the city now, I think if you want to navigate your way around, then you just have to put a bit more effort into being clever in your planning. For sure, you have to get up early in the morning, make the most of that morning. We have a saying that says, quello che si fa la mattina non si fa in tutta la giornata. What one does or manages to achieve in the morning, one doesn't get it done in the whole day, you know, because the morning is that productive time. So that
I can't believe I'm learning about getting more done from an Italian, but that sounds like words to live
in
by.
In the morning,
yeah,
you know, because of the climate.
Yeah.
So if you can be out by 6 o'clock having the most marvelous experiences in the piazzas, in Piazza Navona, in the Fontana, not in the Fontana di Trevi, not in the Trevi Fountain, you're not allowed to do that, but around the Trevi Fountain, even at 6 o'clock in the morning, I think it will still be just you, the garbage sweeper, and let's say a few local colorful people, perhaps.
But these sites can be magnificent in the morning. I would think Campo di Fiori is great when the merchants are setting up.
Absolutely. You can really see that local flavor.
Let's just think about this. What at 7 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning, Campo di Fiori, it's one of the most popular places. It's hot and crowded in the middle of the day. Beautiful market scene. Merchants setting up, I'm sure, at 7 o'clock. The Pantheon, I don't know when it opens, but I've been in the Pantheon all alone, literally all alone. My hotel is always near the Pantheon. And it's early in the morning.
Yeah. And even if it's now, it's increasingly difficult with the Pantheon because you need to make the reservations.
Yeah.
So people are, you know, as soon as it opens, there will be a line there in the morning. But the area around there is still very pleasant. Piazza Navona is magic in the morning with no,
Trevi
with no
fountains,
people.
The Spanish steps, you name it. And then in the middle of the day, you can go to a great museum that might be air conditioned. I think the National Museum is air-conditioned.
Yeah.
And this is, you can spend a few hours in the heat of the day and then take a little siesta and be out in the evening.
Yeah.
But this is the reality. As a society, we've neglected to bite the bullet and deal with climate change ethically and courageously and smartly. And now we're paying the price. And it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse.
So we have to evolve with that situation.
We have to evolve with that and then deal with it in a way that can help moderate it. This is Travel with Rick Steves. I'm talking with Virginia Agustinelli and Vanessa Nicole, both tour guides from Rome. And we're talking about Rome today. And when I think about Rome today, I'm thinking about a huge construction project that's at the Piazza Venezia, just under the famous Victor Emmanuel Monument. It looks like two big green silos, Virginia. You know what I mean?
Yes, it
and
does.
This
it
is
does.
Quite a beautiful square in the very center of town, and now it's a mess.
It's a major project. They're trying to build connect to metro lines, and it's been going on for a long time. So the Romans believe it will never end, and it does block traffic all around the city because, like you said, it's the very heart
this
of Rome.
This is going to be years. They told me, I don't know, 10, 15 years or something like that. I don't know.
They did say that, so that's why the Romans think that it will
It'll
be forever.
If they say 10 or 15
if
years.
If they say 15, it means 30.
But Europe is a work in progress, and especially in Rome, if you're going to build a subway, you have to go deep.
That's true. And it's also if the city needs new metro lines, new metro system, the city has to suffer a little bit before they see an improvement.
It's always worth it.
I think that's what it will be.
But in Seattle, if you go down 20 feet, you don't find anything but dirt. But in Rome, if you go down 20 feet, you find precious ancient ruins. So it's really the nightmare of a builder in Rome, I would think, is you can have your schedule all laid out and then you discover something and all of a sudden, the historians and the archaeologists have to come in and make sure they know what you're doing, understandably so.
Well, they have a wonderful project also in terms of the archaeology and everything that they find because they're going to make it a museum, like a metro station-museum, and they're going to display all the artifacts that they find in that area. So it will be beautiful to walk through that station.
I mean, all my life I've been looking down at Largo Argentina, you know, which is just like a city square block size of an open excavation site where you had the footprints of some old temples from the earlier part of Rome, from the Republic of Rome. And it's a cat sanctuary, right? So there's a lot of cats down there.
Yeah.
But just in the last year or two, they've opened up some exhibits that are just beautiful. And there's walkways and there's information panels. Have you been down there, Vanessa?
Yeah. They're working on that.
I'm liking what Rome's doing with their... And in the Forum, you've got some new dimensions to see.
Yes.
The Domus Domus Tiberiana? And it goes to a church from like ancient Roman times.
And they're also starting to use more... these places that we can visit, and instead of just keeping that to a daily opening schedule, they're organizing things in the evening as well.
Well, tell me more about that, because evening is prime time, it's cooler, you know, you don't have the crowds, and it's a wonderful dimension of Rome. Rome is a huge cultural city, and because of the language barrier, a lot of us don't really take full advantage of it, but what are some things we might want to do in the evening from a cultural point of view?
Even at the Forum in the evening, they're organizing evening visits, which are often they're using multimedia installations and projecting onto the backdrop of the Trajan markets. And you can see the silhouette of the Colosseum, and above they have the lights in a way that they project up into the sky. And so the seagulls that are flying overhead just look like doves. It's quite magical in the moonlight. It's really lovely to do that in the evening.
There's two of those. One, you sit on bleachers and you watch a sound and light show.
Yes.
And then another one is leaving from right there also, where you actually walk through the Forum.
Exactly.
And they're both really good.
Yeah.
They have a festival too along the Tiber River. Vanessa and I were just talking about it. And during this festival, only in the summer months, when the water is not too high, they set up all this kiosk and stands, and you can get your spritz and your drink and walk along the Tiber even later in the day. And it's fun. There's music.
And I've always felt like Rome turns its back on its river. It's got a big embankment. There's plenty of space to walk on the quay. And now they're doing some more organizing there for these cultural events and these sort of food fairs and so
Correct.
On.
There is food fair, there is live music, there is a lot of people doing their passeggiata along the river.
Is that throughout the season?
Throughout the summer, mostly in the summer months.
What's that called?
It's called Estate Romana, summer, the Roman summer.
Estate Romana. So we should put that on our list, I would think.
Yeah, and you can see all the stalls going along the river in the evening. But now what they're doing as well is with the backdrop of where the Castel Sant'Angelo is, they have extended the area. And again, I think this is a recent thing, since people do want to make more of the evenings because of the fact that it's so warm during the day. Yeah. And so they've extended the area that they're using along the river. And there are basically like stage venues where every evening there are live performances of blues and jazz and swing. It's music, it's a bar, it's restaurant by the side of the river in a beautiful backdrop. So people start, they get up, and there's a space where people can dance. And it's that lovely situation where you can get multi-generational recreation going on, which is increasingly harder, you know, to have that kind of situation.
And I can just see it right now. Towering above you is the floodlit Castello Sant'Angelo.
It's magical.
Hadrian's tomb, an ancient Roman castle. That was the tomb of the emperor that the Pope used for his refuge when he had to flee the Vatican.
And meanwhile, you're dancing by the banks of that river in that backdrop. It's called the Terrazza Tevere, the Terrace of the Tiber.
The Terrace of the Tiber. Do you need tickets for that?
You don't need tickets. There's no fee. It's not crowded.
And I'm just thinking, I've got to put that in my book. Yes. I can't believe it's not in my Rome guidebook.
Not probably because this is recent things.
This is new, yeah.
This is recent things.
All right. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking about Rome today with two wonderful Roman guides, Virginia Agustinelli and Vanessa Nicole. We're just about out of time, Virginia and Vanessa, but I do want to talk about the Jubilee year. 2025 is the Jubilee, and the Pope calls for it. I think it's every 25 years. And it's an excuse for lots of devout Catholics to come to Rome and enjoy a very busy and festive season. And it happens to congest Rome as well. What do you anticipate for the Jubilee year? What should we be mindful of? What can we enjoy because of that? And what should we be careful of?
So it will be, like you said, a very busy year for the city of Rome. They're expecting big crowds, but at the same time, you can play it very smart, and reservations are absolutely a must.
Yeah.
At the same time, Rome is a big city, and there are many districts that you can visit. Obviously, the Vatican district is going to be the busiest, there are other sites and like Coppa de district.
So if you're going to do anything related to the Jubilee, it's going to be very, very crowded. The one thing that you'd really want to be careful about is get a hotel as soon as you can.
Absolutely. Reservations as soon as you can are mandatory.
Look, because I'm going to be filming there, and I've looked at the Vatican schedule, and I found a time when it seems like it's a lower ebb. But some weeks are really busy and others are less busy. And you'd want to, you know, unless you want to be there for all of the Vatican celebrations and the religious festivities, you probably wouldn't want to be there on Easter, for example.
That's right. But the positive side will be that all the scaffolding that was up and everything that they're restoring and polishing and cleaning will be finally down, and you'll be able to see this beautiful new Rome, including the Pietà by Michelangelo, which was covered for restoration. It's supposed to come down, and we'll see.
That's something to look forward to. Vanessa, what are your thoughts for travelers considering traveling during Holy Year 2025?
I think that as long as you're prepared, you know it's going to be a bit busier. And sometimes, you know, in the past, it's been the case that people are so panicky about it and it's going to be massive and there's going to be all these people. And actually, it's a whole year when there's an opportunity for people to come. So it often just levels itself out. But as long as you're prepared and bear in mind, exactly, it's all going to be polished and clean and looking perfect
really
in
great.
Order to celebrate this Jubilee year. So actually, you'll see Rome cleaner than you've ever seen it.
Nice. The Eternal City will be looking young and sparkly.
Yay.
Vanessa Nicole, Virginia Agustinelli, mille grazie, and best wishes in your beautiful city of Rome.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Accompagnami,
sorina, la mia bella fornarina, al balcone non c'è più.
We're coming up on the 68th anniversary of one of the darkest episodes of the Cold War. A cross-section of Hungary's population, from college students to factory workers, demonstrated in the streets for democratic rights that its Soviet-backed government denied. The Soviets replied with troops to crush the revolt. Michael Korda was there, and he tells us what it was like next on Travel with Rick Steves. After the end of World War II, most countries in Eastern Europe went from being ruled by German Nazis to being dominated by Soviet Russia. It would take decades for democratic freedoms to be realized. Less than a decade into its communist era, a group of university students in Hungary presented their demands for political and economic reforms to the national radio station. The authorities replied by shooting them dead. It was October of 1956, and college student Michael Korda wanted to see for himself how the student-led revolts were spreading through the population. He joins us in this special interview for Travel with Rick Steves to describe what he experienced. Michael, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, your part is so romantic to me. Age 24, you're an Oxford student in England. Yes, the son of a Hungarian émigré, but you had never been to Hungary.
And no, never.
You had a chance to dive in there like the romantics who went to the Spanish Civil War in the cause of freedom. So in 56, you and three friends from Oxford hopped in a beat-up old V-dub and drove to Budapest with medicine for hospitals.
That is true.
What was that like?
It was strange. I must say that all four of us had done our national service, 2.5 years in the British Armed Services, and supposed that we would have lots of useful advice to give the Hungarian students about fighting. That turned out not to be really the case. They had already learned much more about blowing up tanks than we knew. Mm-hmm. But the sight of the hospital in Budapest, where we went with our load of medications and anesthetics and antiseptics, was extraordinary and reminiscent perhaps of the Ukraine today. People lying in the corridor of the hospital, the hospital being shelled by Russian tanks.
Mm-hmm.
It was so exciting that one did not really feel fear. You only felt fear later on when you looked back at it and said, why on earth did I do that and what was I thinking of?
Well, there was a drama. I mean, when I look at those Hungarian flags that had that Soviet emblem in the middle of them,
right,
and then I see those flags that were, the emblem was literally cut out. So you've got like a donut flag, right? It's got that hole.
Right.
What does that hole mean to you when you look at it as a combatant in this revolution?
It means a determination to rid themselves, not just of the Russians, but of the Russian-sponsored and supported Hungarian government, which was, it was more Stalinist than Stalin.
Oh, my goodness. That's a big statement. Severe
torture, terrible trials over what seemed to us small matters of communist doctrine, all of it ending, of course, in executions. It was a horrendous government, and it impelled the Hungarians to rise up and fight. One reason, by the way, that they were able to is that the Hungarian communist government had always supposed that if a revolution came, it would be coming from the right. And therefore, they filled the factories with arsenals so that if that ever happened, the workers would have access to weapons and ammunition in order to defend themselves and the state. But that enabled the workers to break the arsenals open where they worked and arm themselves against the state, so that within the first few days of the revolution, hundreds of thousands of people armed themselves and fought the Russians.
Michael, you were there. You were there, and the way I understand it, there was a short period of freedom, and it was a world of Molotov cocktails. It was a world of students taking over radio stations. It was a period where Hungarians were like tasting freedom. Tell us a little bit about that whole student-led revolution and the Molotov cocktails being tossed at big, indestructible tanks and the importance of taking a radio station.
Well, we saw plenty of that. I mean, the students were incredible. Now, I have to say that the most incredible thing is that the students and the factory workers and, to some extent, the Hungarian army soldiers all fought side by side, so there were no class differences or education differences in their way. It was a very impressive demonstration of national feeling that was beyond any question of class, profession, or education. And yes, I mean, one saw 18-year-old students run up to Russian tanks. You have to get within 5 or 6 feet of them and throw a Molotov cocktail onto the back of the tank where the engine exhaust and ventilation is. And if you did that successfully, the tank would catch fire and in an instant blow up. Blow up so that it comes completely to pieces and the gun and the turret, you know, end up 100 feet from the tank. Amazing to see it. Amazing that people would do it. But they did.
Yeah. I understand that the Hungarians even turned the street signs around so that when the tanks came in, the Soviet tanks, they didn't know where to go.
That's also true. But by and large, the first stage of the revolution, the first week of the revolution, the Hungarians fought the Russians to a draw, and the Russians evacuated their forces from Budapest, the capital of Hungary, because they were relying on the Russian troops that were present in Hungary, who were mostly national service conscripts. There was then several days during which the Russians pretended to negotiate with the provisional Hungarian government, while in fact they brought up strong professional troops and more modern tanks from the Ukraine and from deep inside Russia, and then attacked and put the revolution down. So the revolution divides itself up into three relatively short periods. It was thrilling and exciting to see a country throwing off its occupiers and getting rid of its government and installing a new one. It was very difficult the last week of the revolution to see how that was put down with such brutality and bloodshed.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're getting an intimate and personal look at the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 today with Michael Korda. Michael is a writer and novelist with more than 20 titles to his name. Born in the United Kingdom to English and Hungarian parents, he served in the Royal Air Force. His role in the Hungarian Revolution earned him the Order of Merit of the Republic of Hungary. We have links to Michael's work in the show notes for this episode at ricksteves.com/radio. Michael's book is Journey to a Revolution, a personal memoir in history of Hungarian Revolution in 1956. Michael, Hungary, to me, always was sort of the odd duck in the Warsaw Pact. It always had a little more feistiness, a little more freedom, a little special kind of communism. when other places were more subservient to Moscow. Can you just very briefly explain how Hungary was different than the neighboring states in the Warsaw Pact?
Yes. Hungary was always a pain in the ass for Moscow because the Hungarians felt themselves drawn to the west, not to the east, and because Hungary is also one of the great, like the Ukraine, one of the great breadbaskets of Europe. It is an enormously productive agricultural country.
And it was a spirited place because I remember in the 1980s, before the wall fell, being on a train with friends from Czech Republic, or Czechoslovakia at the time, going to Budapest because they wanted to go to McDonald's. And it was the first McDonald's in the communist world. And ironically, they stood in line for an hour to get American fast food.
Of course, because it was something new and it was something from the West.
But Hungary was the place you'd go to get a magazine you couldn't get in Prague or you couldn't get in Warsaw.
Now, when
we go to Hungary today, when we go to Budapest, there's a couple of sites that I just think are so powerful. There's the House of Terror and there's the Memento Park. Can you tell us a little bit about, because as I mentioned in the introduction, Hungary went from under the Nazis to under the communists, and they had the secret police in both of those reigns of terror. And today, in what was the clubhouse for this sort of hellish society, you flipped from the headquarters of the secret police under Nazis to the headquarters for the secret police under the communists. And today, it memorializes that in a very powerful way.
Oh, yes, that the House of Terror is amazing and absolutely something that anybody traveling to Hungary should visit, because to my knowledge, there isn't an equivalent. You can go to Moscow, but there's no museum in Moscow that attempts to show you what life was like in the Soviet Union from 1919 to the death of Stalin. And the same is true for the rest of Eastern Europe, but that museum in Budapest is extraordinary and explains both the Hungarian Revolution and much about the failure of communism.
And a powerful takeaway for me, Michael, was at the end of the museum, they have something called the Wall of the Victimizers. And these were the brutal communist police and the people who were participating in this terrible reality for the people of Hungary that survived the fall of communism. And their victims were dead. They survived. They were never brought to justice. And they live just down the street from the loved ones of the people they killed to this very day.
But this is also very true, with all due respect, of Eastern Europe. I mean, the amazing way in which the Germans have placed memorial stones to Jewish families that vanished during the Nazi years is another example of that. I think Europeans are, on the whole, much more conscious of the horrors that the world went through than are we in England or in the United States They remember what we don't.
And it was drilled into them with propaganda and oppressive statues everywhere they looked. You had the Liberation Monument on the hill overlooking Budapest, which just was a reminder of their Moscow overlords. And today, one of the most popular sites in Budapest is the Memento Park, or what a lot of people call Statue Park. Did you go out there and see all these statues?
Yeah, it is. It is extraordinary.
So they didn't melt down the statues. They just collected them in a park outside of town, and now, you know, grandparents can take their kids out there and tell them what it was like in the 1950s.
Yes. Well, some of them are pretty broken up, but the ones that were saved are now there. But that's something you won't find in Russia. The Russians suffer, actually, I think, from an inability to look back at their past in terms of museums and displays. But the Hungarians have done a wonderful job of making it clear just what that past was like. And I think it's one of the many things that makes Budapest a place worth visiting.
You know, that's interesting because in our country now we have a controversy about what do you do with statues of Confederate soldiers? Well, what Hungary did with all the propaganda statues that lionized the people that kept them down was take them out to a park and make a learning experience out of it. You've still got them there, and everybody can go out and remember what their heritage was. And if they want to make a teaching moment out of that for their kids, they can do that.
I think that that's a wonderful thing to do, actually, and a wonderful idea what for what we should have done and ought to be doing here in this country as well.
Michael Korda, it's so great to talk to you. Your book, Journey to a Revolution, a personal memoir and history of Hungarian Revolution in 1956, is a treasure for anybody that wants to better understand the struggle of the people of Central or Eastern Europe when it came to earning and winning their freedom. And when I think about Hungary, it's just such a poignant mix. And I go to Heroes Square, which I think was built in 1896, the 100th birthday of the founding of Hungary, and it celebrates the very first people that came 1,000 years ago to Hungary, reminding locals of the hard-fought history that they have today. When you go to Heroes Square, and when you think of 1,000 years of struggle and the resilience of the Hungarian people, and then when you think of the struggles they had, which you participated in the communist times, 50 years ruled by Moscow, and then you think of the struggles in Hungary today, Hungarian democracy under Viktor Orban, if you want to still call it democracy, how do you bring all that together? What can a takeaway be right now when we think of the challenges that face the Hungarian people and their resilience and their heritage?
Well, I think they've always kept to their heritage. The present government of Hungary is one which we deplore, but at its worst, it's hundreds of times better than what existed under the communist government of Hungary until the fall of the Soviet Union. So I think you have to regard the present political position in Hungary as a way station on the way to something else, not a permanent condition.
I think that's a very hopeful thought.
I hope it is, and I feel that way, certainly.
Because one thing we can learn from history is you just cannot wish freedom away from a proud people like the Hungarians. That will be an ember at a minimum and an inspirational flame when it's left free to thrive. Michael Korda, thanks so much for joining us and best wishes in your teaching and your travels.
Many thanks. Many thanks for having me.
Michael Korda's latest work is Muse of Fire, World War I, as seen through the lives of soldier poets. I recently wrote about my favorite places, people, and stories from a lifetime of exploring Europe in my own book called For the Love of Europe. Here's what I observed after visiting a difficult historical site near Munich. Dachau, forgive but never forget. En route to Dachau's infamous concentration camp, I sit next to an old German woman on the city bus. I smile at her weakly as if to say, I don't hold your people's genocidal atrocities against you. She glances at me and sneers down at my camera. Suddenly, surprising me with her crusty but fluent English, she rips into me. She says, you tourists come here not to learn, but to hate. Pulling the loose skin down from a long-ago strong upper arm, she shows me a two-sided scar. She says, when I was a girl, a bullet cut straight through my arm. Another bullet killed my father. The war took many good people. My father ran a Gruscott shop. I'm stunned by her rage, but I sense a desperation on her part to simply unload her story on one of the hordes of tourists who tramp daily through her town, tramping through to gawk at an icon of the Holocaust. I ask, what do you mean, a Gruscott shop? She explains that in Bavaria, shopkeepers greet customers with a cheery Grüß Gott or Praise God. During the Third Reich, it was safer to change the greeting to Sieg Heil. It was a hard choice. Each shopkeeper had to make it. As more and more shops became Sieg Heil shops, everyone in Dachau knew which shops remained Grüß Gott shops. Pausing, as if mustering the energy for one last sentence, she stands up and says, my father's shop was the last Gruscott shop. Then she steps off the bus. By the end of the line, there were only tourists and pilgrims on the bus. Together, in silence, we walk into the concentration camp. Dachau, founded in 1933, was the first concentration camp, a model camp, and a training ground for wannabe camp commandants who studied such subjects as crowd control and torture. The camp at Dachau was built to hold 5,000, but on Liberation Day in 1945, 30,000 were packed inside its walls. Some 3,000 were so sick that they died after liberation. The number of Dachau deaths is estimated at 40,000, but the total will never be known. Thousands of Russian soldiers were brought here as prisoners, not even registered. They were simply taken into the field and shot. Dachau is both a barbed wire box of memories and an eternal flame for the future. The sound of hushed voices and sad feet on the pebbled walk seems to promise remembrance, while the breeze whispers never again through trees that stand on the parade ground where inmates once stood. A statue, as big as the train cars that brought in the inmates, marks the middle of the camp. It's a black steel tangle of bodies, like the real ones found woven together at the gas chamber door. At its base, in French, English, German, Russian, and Hebrew, is the wish of the survivors. Forgive, but never forget.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio.
Rick Steves Classroom Europe is a fast, free, and fun video archive. It's designed for teachers, travelers, and students. It gives you immediate access to some 500 short video clips from the Rick Steves Europe TV show library. Clips cover European history, art, culture, food, and geography. Google Classroom Europe or visit ricksteves.com to watch clips and create your own playlist. Teachers love it. Students do too.